Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff and the first high-ranking Bush administration official to go public and warn of the usurpation of power by the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal. We will discuss the former vice president's destructive legacy, which is at odds with his no-regrets memoir, In My Time. Then, as the 10th anniversary of 9/11 approaches, we will look into the trillion-dollar terrorist industrial complex with Dr. John Mueller, the author of a new book, Terror, Security and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits and Costs of Homeland Security. Then finally, we'll find out about who is funding the campaign of Islamophobia that has some Americans believing that the nation is about to be subjected to Sharia law. Wajahat Ali, one of the authors of a new study by the Center for American Progress, Fear Inc., The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America, joins us. Joining us now is Lawrence Wilkerson, retired U.S. Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks, Ian. Glad to be with you.
And clearly, we are speaking at the time of the release of Dick Cheney's memoir, and I don't imagine either of us are particularly interested in shilling for the former vice president helping his book sales.
Not at all.
But he makes no regrets. I mean, that's the title of his books, of course. And about waterboarding detainees, he said, I would strongly support using it again if circumstances arose where we had a high-value detainee and that was the only way we could get him to talk. Now, apparently that still resonates with the American public from, I guess, because of TV shows like 24. But yesterday I spoke with a CIA officer who was involved in torturing or the interrogation, I should say, of these high-value targets, Glenn Carl, and I know you know him because you endorsed his book. And it was quite a powerful reminder of the human cost of what Dick Cheney, Addington, and John Yoo unleashed. This was a very decent man caught in an impossible situation. What's your reaction to Glenn Carl's story?
This is one of the lesser known aspects of this entire business. Well known, whether we agree with it or not, are the war crimes of people like Cheney and Rumsfeld and others. Not so well known are the problems, the agonies, the psychological traumas that this creates for those people down in the trenches who, by and large, at the CIA, at the State Department, at the FBI, wherever we might be talking about the government, are decent people and who are trying to do their job to the best of their ability. In Glenn's case, I would submit he's more than a decent person. He's a highly educated, highly talented, linguistically capable in more than one language. CIA guy who sort of fits the mold of the old days when Princeton and Harvard and Yale volunteered for military service and for intelligence service. And he was deeply shocked and still is shocked by the fact that he had people who actually, well, they not only contemplated these sorts of things, but they actually ordered them. And when they found people like Glenn who were not necessarily as indecent as they were, as criminal in some cases as they were, they simply went around them, or they did everything they could to obscure or block what they were trying to protest about or whatever. And whether it's at Hotel California, which he writes about extensively, or whether it's someplace else with a foreign power doing the interrogation while the United States watches, which in my view is even more criminal than doing it yourself, this really tears people's guts. When they're like me in the military, or like Glenn in the CIA, or like others in the DIA, the FBI, and so forth, and they're ordered to do these kinds of things, which fly in the face of everything that their mother and father, their church, their Bible or Talmud or Koran or whatever has told them, this is really rough stuff down at that level, and it ruins morale and it ruins efficiency.
And Colonel Wilkerson, do you think it happened in part because those who foisted this on the military and intelligence establishment, Cheney, Addington, and you, et cetera. None of them have any military service. Is it easier and more cavalier for those that haven't been at the ground level to fall for this kind of macho nonsense?
Yes, it is. And I must add, too, that it's been my experience, some 50 years in the military and government in general, that what you get usually is people who haven't been there where the rubber meets the road, where the bullets fly, where the artillery goes off. You get people who have this bravado, this bravura, this courage, false courage. Shakespeare said, courage in the cannon's mouth. this is not real courage. This is people who haven't been there, don't know what they're asking other people to do, and they're giving orders and they're giving directions without any knowledge of what it's like, for example, to be in the trenches of World War I. That's the war that really stands out for me, where leadership simply didn't know what it was doing, and my God, it killed the manhood of France and Britain and a lot of the manhood of Germany. This is the kind of thing that happens when you have people in decision-making positions who either have no experience whatsoever or will not take the advice or at least listen to the advice of those who do.
And be in denial, as George W. Bush and Dick Cheney were, about what happened in Iraq. The word insurgency was not allowed to be spoken in their presence.
That's true. Years went by. I will say this, from what I've heard George W. Bush say since, at least I find a modicum of contrition with him, and at least some circumspection and some thought, even introspection, about what he's done. I find none of that in Cheney. In fact, Cheney seems to be so adamant that as I said in another interview this morning, that I think Brent Scowcroft was onto something in that interview with The New Yorker back in 2004-2003. Where he said he doesn't recognize Dick Cheney anymore. Is it psychosomatic? Is it genetic? Is it heart attack? Is it medical? What is it? But this man is not the same person that he seemed to be when he was Secretary of Defense, for example, when I knew him, when I was working for Powell, when he was chairman, or even earlier when he was a congressman. Surely he was truly conservative. Surely he had all kinds of views that were weird. Surely he voted against one of the few congressmen who did, the Martin Luther King holiday, for example. But put that weirdness aside, I did not think that he was the kind of person he's showing himself to be today. He's a war criminal.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who retired U.S. Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. You mentioned earlier when we're talking about Glenn Carl, the CIA officer who I spoke with recently about his new book, The Interrogator, and Education. You mentioned Hotel California, because that was the code name for, you know, this black site somewhere in the desert somewhere, probably Jordan, who knows, where this activity took place. But what was the thing that Glenn Carr kept pointing out was that he understood the orders came from Dick Cheney. That he understood. But at the same time, here he is being tasked to interrogate a high-value al-Qaeda target, you know, somebody that's up there in the, you know, two or three in the echelons of al-Qaeda. And he quickly comes to conclude that this guy is, they've got the wrong guy. But the more Glenn Carr has misgivings, the more pressure is put on him to enhance the interrogation. I mean, it's a nightmarish situation.
Well, that's one of the interesting aspects of it. Interesting might not be the right word, disquieting aspects of it from an academic point of view. When I study these things now, and my students study these things and give case studies back to me on it, and I see these human insights about how people are doing these things, and the bureaucracy just gets caught up in the momentum of doing them. And when it's coming from the very top, when Cheney is the pusher down, if you will, is the person putting this policy out, making such statements as he did in general, and these statements are heard by everyone and echoed across the military, across the CIA, across the FBI, and otherwise, statements like the gloves are coming off, we're operating on the dark side, these are the things we're going to have to do. We're in essence going to have to become the people we're after. We're going to have to become as bad as they are. This is the sort of thing that gets out fast, and it's so damaging. It's so damaging that it produces things like Abu Ghraib. It produces things like Bagram in Afghanistan, where we had we actually had people murdered in detention. We had, as I counted last with Human Rights First and others who were documenting these things, over 140 people murdered or killed or died while they were in detention under some suspicion. And as far as I can tell, we have punished very few people for this, very few people, and mostly lower-ranking people.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. Your former boss spoke last weekend on CBS about Cheney's book and some of the disdainful things that Cheney said about Colin Powell and about Condoleezza Rice. And I suppose you have to add to that John McCain, who he also doesn't seem to, it seems to not spare any opportunity to diss Senator McCain. What was your sense of Colin, of your former boss Colin Powell's pushback?
I watched him twice. I ran it through the first time, and then I ran it through a second time with my wife over looking over my shoulder. And I said, well, you know, my remark was, well, twice he called him a distinguished gentleman or a person with a long and distinguished career in government and so forth and so on. But then she said to me, but detect the venom underneath his remarks.
Right.
And so I listened to it again, and I said, yes, you're right. There is some venom underneath his remarks. I don't see how he could be otherwise. I mean, he was very gentlemanly. He was very cordial in the way he criticized the former vice president. But, I mean, here's the guy who went to New York. I mean, I know this intimately because I was the person who prepared him for it. We went to New York in February of 2003, and we essentially told the international community, the American people, and the UN Security Council members that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and we gave all kinds of circumstantial evidence to that effect. We were dead wrong. We were dead wrong, especially on the three pillars of that presentation: mobile biological laboratories for biological weapons production, chemical weapons stocks, and an active nuclear program. We were dead wrong. We went to war and killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and now we're looking at over 4,000 American dead, other coalition members dead, and lots more horribly wounded. And we did all that at least partially based on that evidence of WMD. Powell's the man who did it. So he says in public, I'll forever be remembered as the man who gave that presentation. Well, Dick Cheney then criticizes him for undermining the president's position. You have to be kidding me.
Well, that was the cynical thing about it, wasn't it? That Colin Powell had the most credibility, therefore he was the best salesman.
Absolutely. And Dick Cheney put his finger in his chest, and that must have been a really funny sight to see the six-foot Powell have the five-foot-seven Cheney put his finger in his chest and say, you can afford to lose some polling points, colon. I mean, that's the reason they sent him. He had poll ratings like Mother Teresa at the time, in the low to mid-70s, and sometimes even in the bottom 80s. So they sent him up there for that reason. They sent him up there because he was the person with the most credibility with Americans, and most importantly, really, with Europeans, with whom you will recall we were having some difficulties at the time.
Sure. But do you think, in retrospect, George Tenet set you up? I mean, in the sense that both you and Powell were very skeptical of this intelligence, and you kept, wanting more, but at the same time, you're sitting opposite the head of the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, the guy that's supposed to be the keeper of all the secrets and supposed to know the most. So you have to trust him at the one time, but at the same time, you're deeply skeptical. I mean, I just go back to that moment after 9/11 when President Bush, a couple of days later, showed up at the CIA, put his arm around George Tenet, and essentially said, probably said in private, we're not going to fire you. But was there some kind of mutual deal made there that there wouldn't be any recriminations,
I think this is something I try to communicate to my students. It's rarely communicated directly. It is exactly as you just described it. It is a warm hug by the President of the United States. It is a wink and a nod. It's an understanding. It's never articulated. I'm reading now the correspondence between Khrushchev and Kennedy during the 1961 Berlin crisis when they built the Berlin Wall, and then subsequently during the 1962, October 62 Cuban Missile Crisis. And what you see here, as well as the advisors around Khrushchev and the advisors around Kennedy, is exactly what you and I are talking about. This suggestion, this major powerful figure standing beside a lesser figure and suggesting and hinting that there will be payback, that there will be remuneration, that there will be good things for you, George, if you just go along with this. And that's what happened. There's no other way I can describe it but that Vice President Dick Cheney, through unprecedented visits to the CIA, more than any major member of the government, let alone a member of the NSC, to the CIA 11, 12 times, Dick Cheney brought pressure on those people out there, pressure that was added to by George Bush's warm hug and not firing him and so forth, that said to George, look, you go along with the fact that, as the Downing Street memo said, that the policy is being shaped or the intelligence is being shaped around the policy that we're going to war with Iraq and you better come up with the evidence to support it, or else. And else meant no Medal of Freedom for George Tenet, no more continuation as the DCI, head of the CIA, et cetera, et cetera. That's the way you get things done in government, unfortunately. And if they're for the positive, okay. If they're for the negative, then you got a problem, in my view. And we've got a significant problem in this country with the war power, with the president using the war power, with the ease with which he does it and so forth. And because of what we've just described, the ease with which he brings others along with him.
And Colonel Wilkerson, clearly if you will, I hate to use or hesitate to use the word cover-up, it continues in terms of what's happening with Ali Soufron, the FBI interrogator, who some time back wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying that that these enhanced methods of torture were a total failure and were not just immoral, they were impractical and counterproductive.
Now we see his book apparently is being so heavily redacted by the CIA and others in the government that one wonders if it'll even read. Glenn Carls, as he may have told you, was heavily redacted.
Sure.
Too.
You can see it. It's there.
Yeah.
Black
Glenn
lines.
Had some neat footnotes, though.
right. No. But the thing is this an institutional cover-up or is this a personal cover-up, do you think, in terms of George Tenet? Because, I think what Ali Soufron is saying is that had the CIA shared the information about those two hijackers in San Diego, they could have perhaps prevented 9/11.
I think it's both, Ian. I really do. I think Cheney is the person at the root of it, and I think he corrupted the institutions sufficiently to follow along in his stead. Here's a man who's president, and you know how I believe, he was the president for national security affairs in the first Bush administration.
Well, he had a bigger National Security Council than the president had.
Yes. Here's two people, George Bush and Dick Cheney, who were responsible for over 3,000 American deaths, worse since Pearl Harbor. Their first reaction is to batten down the hatches and say, wow, we can't be blamed for that. We might be thrown out of office if we are, ignominiously even. We might be impeached. So we've got to really be aggressive, and we got to make sure, one, it doesn't happen again, and two, that we don't get blamed for it. That's something we forget as a country. We forget that it happened on Dick Cheney and George Bush's watch. It happened on my watch and Colin Powell's watch. But I would submit their responsibility is more significant than ours because we were responsible for the foreign policy overseas portfolio, not for the security of the United States in the direct sense. They were. And they were found at fault. And the first reaction they had was to cover that up and to make sure that when the president went to New York and got on that debris pile with that bullhorn, his poll rating shot up rather than shot down. And they did. It was a very deft political move, and Karl Rove was right when he exclaimed that, if we exploit this to the max, we can be in power for a long time.
Well, of course, that has given rise to these ridiculous conspiracy theories that that somehow the most incompetent regime in since the Buchanan's presidency was somehow cleverly able to get a bunch of Arabs to fly planes into buildings to rescue the failing presidency. But that nonsense aside, there's no question that George W. Bush did not get elected to enact the agenda that he did post 9/11. He was essentially a lame duck before 9/11. And how many weeks of vacation did he take?
Quite a few. Right. I think he outstripped Ronald Reagan.
Right.
But I have to say, when you look back on that election and you look back on that Supreme Court decision, and then you look at how the Supreme Court is acting on major decisions today, you wonder if the third branch of government hasn't gone awry in a way that is really damaging to the fabric of this republic.
Well, can we end on a cheerful note here?
Please, let's find one. My reading did not kill a whole lot of people, even though it did kill a few, which is tragic.
Right. Well, I'm counting on you to come up with something here, but I guess...
My positive note is that the students I'm teaching understand all this and seem to be poised to do something about it, and I hope to hell they do.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thanks, Ian.
Thanks again. I've just been speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is a retired U.S. Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment speaking about the terrorist industrial complex.
Like Coltrane, insane. Yesterday, but to me, I'm a different kind. We're brothers of the same mind. I'm blind, caught in the middle end, not surrendering. I don't ride for the sake of riddling. Claiming I'm a smuggler. Some say I never heard of ya. A rap burglar. False media. We don't need it, do we?
His fingers will it be you, dig me? Yo, Terminator, never fall in stand and show these people what's happening.
Here we go again.
Don't believe that.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. John Mueller, who is a political scientist in the field of international relations, who is recognized for his ideas concerning the banality of ethnic war and the theory that major world conflicts are quickly becoming obsolete. His books include Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them, and Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda. He currently is the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of both political science and dance at Ohio State University. He has written a new book that will be out next week, Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Mueller.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And clearly with the 10th anniversary of 9/11 fast approaching, do you think there's going to be some reflection on how Homeland Security expenses have risen by more than $1 trillion? And that doesn't include the costs of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
I certainly hope so, but there's no guarantee. There does seem to be something of a change of mood. The financial crunch has obviously played into that. And also the death of bin Laden sort of cleared the air in some respects. So maybe it'll happen, but there's this phrase about a self-licking ice cream cone. And once you get something like this going, you know, like the drug war or like chasing communists during the Cold War, it tends to be self-perpetuating. So we'll have to see if there's going to be a real shakeup or not.
It's what the Chinese communists used to call the iron rice bowl.
Yeah, that's right. Just keeps going.
So do you think then that there'll be some reflection over this coming 10th anniversary of 9/11 of the basic question that's always asked, are we safer? And the point in your new book, Terror, Security and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits and Costs of Homeland Security, is that one of the points is that you're saying that's the wrong question. We shouldn't be asking, are we safer? The correct question is, are any gains in security worth the funds expended?
Yes, that's a key issue. I and my co-author, Mark Stewart, have really tried to assess that. The issue basically, fundamentally, is that your chances as an American, for example, of being killed by a terrorist at present rates are about 1 in 3.5 million per year. So the question really is, the key question is, how much money do you want to spend to make that even lower? And also that there are a lot of things you can spend money on to improve human safety and welfare, and whether you want to continue to spend that kind of money or increase that kind of money to deal with one threat, one hazard, which is terrorism, is really questionable. There are a lot of things that kill lots more people and where the funds could possibly be do a lot more good than dealing with a relatively limited problem.
And do you think that if we didn't spend these funds, the terrorism problem would become bigger and not as limited as it is? That's obviously the rationale.
Yeah, that's it. Well, the question is, if your chance of 1 in 3.5 million is where it is now, if it got more dangerous and your chances of being killed by terrorists were now 1 in 2.5 million, would that really be, and you could save a ton of money and use it for other things, would that be a bad deal? That's the kind of consideration that should be there. There are people dying from automobile accidents, there's people dying from all kinds of pollution, there are people dying from cancer, obviously. There's a lot of things you can spend money on, and since nobody has an infinite budget, you have to make choices, and the choices should be, in the matter of public safety and of human well-being, to spend the money most expeditiously where it'll do the greatest good for the greatest number. Instead, what the process tends to be is sometimes called management by inbox. You're sitting there and a problem perks up because someone took a pot shot at somebody in Little Rock, Arkansas or something, and you say, well, that's the big problem. We have to deal with people shooting people in Little Rock, Arkansas. Well, maybe that is a problem, but that's not very good analysis. You have to go well beyond that to see whether it's worth spending a lot of money on. And simply being able to imagine, dire consequences doesn't mean it's worth spending money on them. People say it's conceivable that something would happen. But of course, that's obviously true because they proved that it's conceivable because they just conceived of it. What you have to do is step further than that and say, is it really worth spending a lot of money to deal with or not? Sometimes it may be, but many times it's not. And what's happened with the Department of Homeland Security in particular is they simply haven't asked that kind of question and done that kind of analysis. Mark and I, when we started this out, thought, well, what we do is we'd sort of do a critique. We'd look at their reports, and from a risk analytics standpoint, he's a risk analyst and an engineer in Australia, and we just sort of see, look at their assumptions, look at their data, and say, well, this looks pretty good, and this one looks like it needs repairs, and this one has problems. But when we started looking into it, we couldn't find any reports whatever. They were making decisions without doing the same kind of analysis one should do, and in fact, they do for natural hazards, like earthquakes or, tornadoes. And we were a little bit worried for a while there because we thought, well, maybe it's there. We just can't find it somehow. It's classified or confidential or something. But then a couple of years ago, Congress, I don't know why, but I'm glad they did it, funded a study by the National Academy of Sciences about this kind of decision-making in the Department of Homeland Security. The report came out a year ago, generated zero press, I must say. But the report from the National Academy of Sciences, after nearly 2 years of work, said that DHS essentially doesn't know what the hell it's doing. The way they didn't put it quite that indelicately, but basically what they said was we couldn't find any reports, any analyses that were credible that justified the money they've been spending. And since the increase, as you mentioned earlier, of spending since 9/11 is over $1 trillion in 10 years, that's really quite an indictment, it seems.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a co-author of a new book that'll be out next week, Terror, Security and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits and Costs of Homeland Security. And of course, you have to, what you've just said, Dr. Mueller, it has to be put in the context of of the fact that bin Laden was recently killed by the special forces, and that just the other day yet another number two or three of al-Qaeda was killed by a drone attack, I believe. So they keep killing off the number twos and threes, and they killed off the head guy. And you hear these conflicting reports that al-Qaeda is all but finished on the one hand, and then the other, then a few days later you hear the reverse, you know, that they're planning some, you know, another spectacular attack. So what do you think is going on here?
Well, it's threat inflation is what's going on here. The we've been hearing this for 10 years. In fact, in a book and other writings, what I'm trying to do is get up a website that has all the predictions about what's going to happen. Both those predictions by Osama bin Laden has been saying for decades, we've got operations of the way, they're going to hear him soon. You're going to be hit by them soon. And certainly by, directors of the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI and other things saying they're going to be here pretty soon. None of which have come true. A good way of looking at this, which we were able to put together, is to look at how many people in the entire world since 9/11, outside of war zones, have been killed by Islamic extremist terrorists. And there's several people who compiled those data. It doesn't make for very pleasant reading, but it comes out, including, you know, the Bali attack and the London attack and the Madrid attack and attacks in Saudi Arabia and so forth, that outside of war zones, Muslim extremist terrorists have killed between maybe 200 and 400 people in the whole world, outside of war zones. Now, that's 200 to 400 too many, obviously, but it's obviously also a rather limited threat. If you put it in context, the number of people who die drowning in bathtubs every year in the United States is about 320. So that's about basically the range. I don't want to trivialize those murders by the terrorists, but nonetheless, the number is, to say the least, does not present much of an existential threat. And that's when bin Laden was alive and the al-Qaeda was supposedly gearing up for a new spectacular attack. They simply haven't done anything remotely like that. And even if you had everybody, when I'm talking about, this includes al-Qaeda, includes al-Qaeda lookalikes, wannabes, maybes, and so forth. You still get those kinds of numbers. So again, I don't want to trivialize those people are, you know, there's a monstrous deaths and everything, but the numbers remain really quite limited and don't necessarily justify massive expenditures to deal with them.
Well, the other thing I think that's worth adding to this mix, Dr. John Mueller, again, the co-author of this new book out next week, Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. As much as the United States government or governments, because this continues, Homeland Security is a vast, well-funded boondoggle, arguably, the threat inflation is even greater in amongst Middle Eastern despots. Look at Gaddafi, he justified his entire rule on that I'm the guy that's stopping Al Qaeda taking over. The same happened in Tunisia. The same happened with Mubarak. The same is happening with the Assad clan, who are killing their own people in Syria, etc. So I guess it's a Middle Eastern phenomenon as well, right?
Yes. I mean, people are always trying to sell threat, always trying to sell fear, and sometimes it sells well and sometimes it doesn't. The things you mentioned, like Gaddafi's claim and so forth, do not sell very well. But particularly because of 9/11, but other things as well, the threat of terrorism is selling rather well. And it's obviously generated a terrific amount of money into various people's pockets and into various bureaucracies. But that doesn't relieve the people in charge from still making a sensible, careful analysis of how that money should be spent and whether, indeed, that much money should be spent. So that, you know, what I mentioned before, your chance of being killed is 1 in 3.5 million. We've been looking very, very hard to find any public official who's ever said anything like that. That's, in our view, that's where you should start. What's the risk? What's the danger? What's the likelihood you're going to be killed by a terrorist? Okay, 1 in 3.5 million per year. We've only found one person who said that publicly among, you know, the officials and bureaucrats, and that was Mayor Bloomberg of New York in 2007. He said, get a life, your chance of being killed by terrorists is probably about the same as being killed by lightning, which is roughly correct. But he's the only one who's ever done that. On the positive side, it should be pointed out that Mayor Bloomberg is still mayor of New York. By broaching this terrible subject of that maybe your chance of being killed are not very high, he didn't ruin his reelection prospects in the least. So it may be that politicians can actually say this banal fact and put it over, and maybe that will help drive down some of the fear levels, which is supporting these tremendous expenditures.
Well, of course, also former Secretary of State Colin Powell, in an offhand remark at a university, I think in Oklahoma, some time back, referred to the danger of a terrorism industrial complex emerging. Would you say that has already happened, Dr. Mueller?
Yes. Yeah, I did a book in 2006 called Overblown, and one of the main things was sort of identifying and dealing with what I call the terrorism industry. And like Eisenhower, you know, when Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial complex, he didn't necessarily say these are diabolical, you know, devil-type characters. They're basically carrying out their own self-interest, and they're very sincere, and they come up with these arguments, and they genuinely are trying to help the society. That doesn't mean they're right, and also that they profit, it turns out, from these predictions and these claims. The same thing happens with terrorism. The bureaucrats presumably worry that if they say your chances of being killed are 1 in 3.5 million per year, the response is going to be, then, how come we're spending so much money? How come we're giving you so much money? Politicians are worried that if they say that, people will say, well, you don't care about the people who died on 9/11. You're not taking the threat seriously. As I've already suggested, Mayor Bloomberg did exactly that, and he did not get drummed out of office. And then there's also people selling things to the government. If you're selling X-ray machines and the government is spending TSA, the Transportation Security Administration, is spending tons of money in X-ray machines, you're in Washington in a heartbeat. And when you get there, you don't say, well, you don't really need my machines, but if you want to buy some, I've got them here. What you tend to say is, boy, you really need these machines because, you know, we got to worry about public safety and all that. May I get a terrorist on board?
I have to add to that, Dr. Mueller, is that this is where I think the situation is out of control and is somewhat disreputable, if you will. You've got the former head of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, running a business that's selling X-ray machines, for God's sake.
Yeah, that's right. Not exactly an unknown phenomenon in government. Of course, he's probably being quite effective because he knows exactly the organization and who are the people you have to get to and so forth.
Well, he appointed them, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, these are people that he hired.
Yeah, Chertoff, by the way, was a guy in 2007 or something who told the reporters at the editorial board of the Chicago Tribune that his gut was telling him there'd be a terrorist attack that summer, which I found extremely irresponsible, because here's what he's doing. He's saying, I have no evidence whatever, but I think we have to really worry about an attack this summer. And given, you know, if I said that, it wouldn't make much difference, but the fact that he's head of Department of Homeland Security is really irresponsible, it seems to me, because he's making a claim and a fear based on nothing, by his own admission, based on nothing. But anyway, that's a standard thing in Washington, of course. People leave office, and then they start working for the people who are selling things to the government. But they still have to be able to sell them, and the people in charge do not have to buy just because Michael Chertoff is a nice guy or they're impressed by him. They still have to make rational and sensible decisions about how to expend their money. And again, it's basically, you know, you're dealing with public safety, but the domestic tranquility of the government, of the country, the most important thing that government does, and to do that irresponsibly is really a real problem, it seems to me.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who is the co-author of a new book that'll be out next week, Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. You were recently quoted in an article in the Los Angeles Times that questioned some of these Homeland Security expenditures. And apparently there's a kind of trickle-down effect of all this money being pumped into local police departments. And, of course, we just learned recently that a CIA officer has a desk at the NYPD, which is in violation of the charter of the CIA, forbidding them from involved in domestic intelligence. But just in terms of these small rural communities, where if you think the threat is 1 in 3.5 million of being killed by a terrorist, if you're out in the middle of nowhere, the threat is probably 1 in 10 million. And yet they're spending money on scuba gear and all kinds of sophisticated stuff when, you know, it's just it's almost laughable.
Yes, it is. There's various exposés over the years about, some of the expenditures, protecting a Mule Day parade someplace in the middle of Illinois and things like that. And it's just sort of a grab bag, and people have all this money. And so if you're cagey at the local level, you're in Washington trying to scrounge as much of it as you can. It's security by pork barrel. And it also is just an irresponsible way to expend public treasury, particularly when you're dealing with public safety.
So, just in closing, Dr. John Mueller, what are you hoping your book will do in terms of its impact?
I hope it would. It will not solve the problem. We're not trying to end anything. We're trying to start something. It seems to me that after 10 years. It's absurd that we have to write a book saying, you know, we ought to be discussing these expenditures in a sensible way. It should have been done automatically, and maybe not in 2001 because everybody couldn't start to know what the depth of the problem was. But certainly by 2003, and certainly by 2006, 5 years later, and it still hasn't happened. So what we really hope to do is start what might be called an adult conversation about these massive expenditures. Some of them, after examination, may prove to be really quite valuable and really helpful in reducing the danger. Others are likely to fail that cost-benefit analysis. But if we do that routinely, the same people do this routinely for natural hazards, it seems to me that those skills and abilities and processes should now be applied to this other hazard, the hazard of terrorism.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. John Mueller.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who's a political scientist in the field of international relations, who is recognized for his ideas concerning the banality of ethnic war and the theory that major world conflicts are quickly becoming obsolete. His books include Overblown, How Politicians and Terrorism and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them, and Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda. He's currently the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor in both political science and dance at Ohio State University. He has co-authored a new book that will be out next week, Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about who is funding Islamophobia in the United States.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists, bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists, bound to lose.
Yes,
all you fascists, bound to lose. You're bound to lose, you fascists, bound to lose.
Yeah.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Wajahat Ali, who is a Muslim-American playwright of Pakistani descent, an expert on Islamophobia for the Center for American Progress. Ali's essays and interviews on contemporary affairs, politics, and the media, popular culture, and religion frequently appear in The Washington Post, The Guardian, Salon, Slate, The Wall Street Journal, Huffington Post, CNN, and Counterpunch. His play about Muslim Americans, Domestic Crusaders, premiered off-Broadway and broke box office records in 2009. He blogs at Goat Milk and Intellectual Playground. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wajahat Ali.
Thanks so much for having me, and I appreciate it.
And just this recent report that came out, 130-page report, Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. You worked on that report. It singles out several Jewish family organizations that support right-wing causes, and some of the usual suspects here on the American right, including Richard Mellon Scaife, who was one of the principal funders of the attempt to impeach President Clinton. First of all, what kind of success do you think the connection between the money and the public consciousness has this 10-year campaign created?
Well, yeah, thank you so much. You know, a six-month investigative report and an expose fact-based on how seven funders have given nearly $43 million, nearly over a 10-year period, to a small interconnected group of individuals and organizations that the evidence shows have been primarily responsible for mainstreaming fear, bigotry, and hate against Muslims and Islam in America. It's very interconnected. So everything begins with the money, because the money empowers these individuals. Specifically, the network is broken into five categories: the money trail. The second one is the Islamophobia scholars and experts. This is the central nervous system, really, Ian, a group of five individuals who belong to think tanks, who are responsible for manufacturing much of the memes and messages that then get mainstreamed vis-a-vis the other categories in the network, such as the grassroots organizations, the media megaphones, such as Fox News and the blogosphere, and then finally, political players who use it as talking points. Islamophobia is a lucrative cash cow, Ian. These individuals who I mentioned, none of them take home less than six figures. And they do this as their daily job. This is their daily bread. So this manufacturing of Islamophobia, you know, this nonstop 24/7 industry, if you will, is fueled by the money. So we decided to use, uncover the research, go to publicly available documents, 990s, and trace it. And we believe if you really want to end Islamophobia, if you really want to marginalize and expose these people and limit their negative influence, then you have to call out the funders and say, hey, if you didn't know that you're funding these people with an agenda, now you know. What are you going to do about it?
So let's go through the five people that are the intellectual architects of this orchestrated bigotry. Frank Gaffney, of course, he's well known as a shill for the military-industrial complex. He's at the Center for Security Policy. Daniel Pipes at the Philadelphia-based Middle East Forum. I don't know whether he's still the head of the United States Institute of Peace, but he had that position appointed by the Bush administration. Steve Emerson, of the Investigative Project on Terrorism. By the way, Steve Emerson was the guy at the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, was first out of the gate to blame it on a couple of Jordanians, when, of course, it turned out to be homegrown American apple pie terrorism. Just let me start with him, because I find him so discredited. How does he stay in business? He's gotten things so wrong for so long.
Yeah, Steve Emerson actually is, because I think he was one of the first ones in the game in 1994. If you remember, he went from journalist to mainstream Islamophobia peddler through his PBS documentary Jihad in America, which won an award, but those who really reviewed it criticized it for creating mass hysteria against Arabs and Muslims. And you said it right now that in 1995, he was the one who, before there was any evidence whatsoever, blamed the Oklahoma City bombing on Muslims, saying this is a, you know, it bared the hallmark traits of Muslims, and ended up being Timothy McVeigh. And 1997, Associated Press tried to rely on him for research, and then they said it seemed what he gave them was manufactured and made up, and he would, they would be very, very, very leery of using him. The reason I think why he's still successful in, and in business, is because many of these people in the Islamophobia network that you've mentioned, Ian, they've been very successful as posing themselves off as authentic experts on Islam, or basically doing fundamental important research on national security and terrorism, which has been a very successful guise to hide their anti-Muslim agenda. And furthermore, the network, as you see in the report, is very, dare I say, incestuous, interconnected, and self-reliant, thus promoting one another as experts, not only the media, but also law enforcement agencies. And so, you know, the Tennessean newspaper did a great expose on Steve Emerson last year, and essentially they said his think tank, Investigative Project on Terrorism, now solicits money by telling donors they're in imminent danger from Muslims. So we have to realize we're living in a very politically and economically uncertain climate where many people are naturally afraid, and these people exploit the misinformation, fear, and I would say even ignorance that people have about Muslims and Islam, and you know, emerge as what they say as the defenders of national security. And that's why some people readily give them money without realizing what their really anti-Muslim agenda that's behind it.
Again, I'm speaking with Wajahat Ali, who is an expert on Islamophobia for the Center for American Progress, who released a report, Fear Incorporated, The Roots of Islamophobia, of the Islamophobia Network in America. And you mentioned that $42 million have gone into it now. The money, of course, has gone into, the case of this fellow, Robert Spencer, who has the Jihad Watch website. He's a program of David Horowitz's Freedom Center, and they get their money from SCAFE and the Bradley Foundations. So I take it so do these other groups here. Pipes's group gets money. Which other groups? I'm looking here at your list.
The Becker Foundations give money to Pipes and Horowitz. Russell Berry gives money the Middle East Forum, which belongs to Pipes. We have Richard Mellon Scave gives millions to David Horowitz. He gives about $3.4 million to the David Horowitz.
That's right, yeah. Well, you know, he used to be a left winger.
And the Bradley Foundation gives $4 million. Exactly. So this is...
I can tell you, Wajahat, here at Pacifica, where we operate on shoestring, in spite of this canard out there that the conservatives in this country keep beating like a dead horse, that there's such a thing as a liberal media, and that there's this powerful kind of liberal juggernaut out there, the truth of the matter is that there's no money on the left. And I'm sure Horowitz, any migrating from the left, has discovered it's much more lucrative to be a right winger.
I mean, David Horowitz makes nearly $500,000 a year. Frank Gaffney takes home an income of $300,000. Robert Spencer, whom you mentioned, runs Jihad Watch, which is a subsidiary of David Horowitz's Freedom Center. And Robert Spencer, who also co-created the hate group Stop Islamization of America with Pamela Geller, which was actually criticized by the Anti-Defamation League as being a conspiratorial anti-Muslim grassroots organization, he takes home $200,000. So, Ian, if you want some more money, I think it's good to create a fictitious boogeyman and get money from funders to say that you're fighting that boogeyman. But, of course, I think it comes at the expense of becoming the villain in our children's history books.
Well, you know, in a way, this whole thing could be laughable because it's such an absurd. I remember that during the Cold War there was an old joke by Mort Sahl, which was that the Russians arrested an American for spying and the Americans retaliated by arresting an American for spying. And there is this kind of knee-jerk, self-inflicted wound that the war on terror has created in this country. But, the notion that there is this this Sharia law onslaught in the country, that somehow, somewhere, there's a group of mullahs trying to impose Sharia law on America, so much so that Horowitz and company have had to go out to the Midwest and get the legislature in Kansas to pass a law banning Sharia law when nobody was even proposing it in the first place. I mean, isn't there a comedic kind of...
Exactly. What you've mentioned is there's a black humor here in absurdity, and if this was a comedy sketch, maybe we can. It would be a Monty Python, Monty Python sketch, but unfortunately it's real. And it, you know, reflects sometimes the darkest parts of American history, where sometimes we lose our moral compass when we succumb to fear and hysteria. But the reason why I'm hopeful, Ian, is because this, what's happening to Muslims right now, and what's happening to those of Middle Eastern descent, this is simply a remake. The characters now are Muslims. In the past, we've seen that there were Japanese Americans, Jewish Americans, and Irish Catholic. And eventually, it does become so absurd and becomes so crazy that most Americans wake up and say, wait, what's happening here? You know, why are we dividing one another again, you know, among religious and ethnic lines? Why are we scapegoating one another? It's gone too far. Enough's enough. And that's why I'm hopeful, because these people, like you mentioned, it's so absurd that, you know, they said that Governor Christie of New Jersey, they've accused him of palling around with the radical Islam simply because he nominated a thoroughly qualified Muslim American, Sohail Muhammad, to the Superior Court. They say that the Conservative Political Action Conference, the annual conference, has been infiltrated by radical Islam simply because they invited Grover Norquist, the anti-tax reformer who's married to a Muslim woman, and Republican Sohail Khan to speak. They said, Steve Emerson, I think, said that Governor Christie has a 10-year for radical Islam. They've accused the Obama administration and even the Bush administration of being infiltrated by radical Islam simply because there was outreach to Muslim American communities. I mean, when it comes to this, right, it becomes so absurd that I think people who, once it's exposed, and I think now it's finally exposed, most right. people, even conservatives, once they view this, they go, wait a second, this is crazy. That's exactly what Governor Christie said. This is crazy and this is nonsense. And I'm hoping that people regain their moral compass and say, you know what, this is not how we do business in America. And so this is what the report does. It really exposes sure. their agenda. And I'm hopeful that now we can hopefully turn the course towards some common sense and civility, hopefully.
Well, it's also, in terms of national security, Islamophobia is the most counterproductive thing that you could have in this so-called war on terror, because no Christian or Jew can dissuade a young Muslim from the path of radicalism. The only people that can dissuade and win the war on terror, if that's possible, are moderate Islamists. And if we scapegoat and demonize them, then we are truly shooting ourselves in the foot. Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and I really appreciate the conversation, and thank you for highlighting the report, and thanks to the listeners for tuning in. Take care.
Take care. Again, I've been speaking with Wajahat Ali, who is a Muslim-American playwright of Pakistani descent. His play about Muslim-Americans' domestic crusaders premiered off-Broadway and broke box office records. He blogs at Goat Milk, an intellectual playground, and he is one of the contributors to the report on Islamophobia from the Center for American Progress. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.